Now, they had bands play live at Trafficante at Midway Center, right?
On occasion, yeah, there'd be a band that would play out there right in mm-hmm. front of the store.
Did the Paisleys do that?
I believe we did. Because Rick Youngberg used to teach guitar for Trafficantes. And Rick Youngberg knew about Jimi Hendrix, and he knew about the Marshall amplifiers that Jimi Hendrix had been provided in England. So when they came to the States, the Marshall amp was brand new. And Rick knew that, and he counseled Ralph Trafficante to get, you should get these amps here. So Ralph took his advice, got the Midwestern State franchise for selling the Marshall amplifiers, and Ralph made quite a bit of money on it. And he always, he and his wife Anita Trafficante, they would always invite us over, and they would make these dinners for the band and our wives, and they just loved the heck out of us. A lot of people don't know, but Ralph Trafficante and his wife Anita, they pioneered an accordion teaching method. It's still in use today. Ralph was wanted to be a concert pianist, but you know, one thing led to another, and so he just loved music, and he had this store. And once he got that Marshall amplifier franchise, why, all the rock bands were buying them. And he made a lot of money. And at one time, Ralph was so thankful that he decided he wanted to hear the Paisleys make an album. So he hired, well, I don't know, I can't maybe use the word hired Warren Kendrick.
I think he steered us all together.
But he gave, as I understand the gist of this, Ralph Trafficante gave Warren Kendrick about $5,000 to record the Paisleys, to record an album for the Paisleys. And Warren Kendrick then got probably some help from Brown Institute down the street on Lake Street there, where our part of the deal to gain the album and to have these master tapes delivered, we built that studio. So the Paisleys were hired by Warren Kendrick then to build the studio.
And let's get the address on that. Would be 3009 East Lake Street.
That's correct.
And the studio was to become Audio City.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that studio was built under the direction of Warren Kendrick, and the Paisleys did most of the manual labor. And we know that Ralph Trafficante had initially made quite a bit of money outlay to Warren. Later on, things were to kind of go south between Warren and...
When did you start recording the Paisleys album at Audio City?
Summer of 69.
Yeah.
Well, the summer of 69.
Yep.
Okay. How long did you spend building out the studio?
Boy, that would... My memory is, Dick, that it took most of like 2 months.
Yeah, it did. It took quite a bit because we renovated a completely bare building.
Okay, so you're recording your first album, and only album, I guess. Well, sort of. And how long are you in the studio with Warren Kendrick to record the album?
Well, I'm not sure the actual timeline.
Well, we had basically unlimited time in the studio because of the work we were doing.
From that standpoint.
But
yeah.
how many hours we spent in the studio recording that's a tough question to answer.
Now, Bob, are you back to record on this album?
I am on the album. When I left, the album was recorded completely, except for Wind. When I left, I was told that Michael copied my drumming, and actually, they put Michael's drumming on, I believe,
Universe or the Musical Journey.
Musical Journey, yeah.
So you're not credited on the album. But you're playing all the drums except for Musical Journey.
On the album, yeah.
On the album. Mm-hmm. Now, the album comes out on the Peace label. What's the story behind the Peace label?
Well, at the time we were looking, well, what are we going to call this? What are we going to do? So I had suggested the Peace label. The Peace sign was kind of universal at that time. And we would throw in all these other names. What are we going to call it and all this? So the Peace sign as the label was my inner contribution there. And then we were drawing out the peace signs and making various diagrams. We did a lot of our own artwork and ideas on paper. Bill drew the cover of the album. Bill was kind of sick one night, he said, and we were a little pressed to find an album cover. So as I understand it, he got himself together and probably smoked a lot of roofers. And I think also he said he was drinking this cough syrup, if I remember right.
Now, Richard, I understand Marsh Edelson was very interested in the Paisley's album, as far as the master tapes.
Well, at the time, he was. Marsh was very high on the Paisleys. He thought we were uniquely different than most of the other bands. But he also was a booking agent, so he had a lot of other bands. And at the time, he had made arrangements out on the East Coast, I believe, to be visiting some of the larger recording companies and publishing companies, and his idea was to be going out there and to shop his bands and try to gain contracts at another level of the business. And he was very, very high on the Paisleys, and he had anticipated and expected that we were going to give him the Paisley master to take out there to showcase the group. That never happened, and we did not know about this till later. Warren Kendrick was supposed to have delivered the master tape to Marsh. When we found out that Warren did not give the tape to Marsh, Marsh was just livid. He went through the whole gamut. I mean, he got angry. He got let down. He crashed.
You told me he was waiting at the airport?
Yeah. Marsh said he was waiting at the airport. He said he waited at the top steps to the airplane, and Warren did not bring the tape. So, you know, that was a big letdown kind of for everybody at that time. And at that time, then, that was more or less, we were done with Warren. Marsh lost interest, too. I think we were just too uniquely different to be booking on a continuous kind of performance thing.
So Warren Kendrick decides to release the album, and how many albums are pressed up?
I understand there were about 2,000 copies made.
That's what I was told, yeah.
And where were they pressed?
I believe it was Heilicker Brothers, okay. Soma Records.
Okay.
It wasn't released on Soma label. That was their own label. But so we released it on the Peace label. But now, we didn't know how to do that, so Warren assumed, well, he's going to publish it under his publishing company, and that tape should have went to us, and we were to give that to Marsh. And when that didn't happen, that was a real letdown.
And now Warren Kendrick has passed away, and his estate is the owner of the master tapes, I would assume.
That's what I heard. I heard it was his son Wesley or Westy had them.
I was able to find a Connie's Insider dated December 20 to 27, 1969, and the Insider reported that KQRS was playing Wind off the new Paisley album. So I'm assuming maybe there were promo copies that came out in late 69, because typically the year of release is referred to as 1970.
What we were doing back then in 69 was when we would record a song, a lot of times we would get a cassette tape of it, and we would go to KQ and give them a promo tape.
Alan Stone?
Alan Stone, exactly. Alan would play it at night. Now, KQ was a whole different entity back then. It was considered at the time an underground FM station. Alan would play the Paisley music at night, and so he kept it a kind of a library. Wind, I have to say, I was so jealous that that didn't get written when I was still playing with the band, because I love that song. But yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if Alan played that on KQ.
He also wrote the liner notes on the back of the album. Yeah.
That's when I got
a copy. Well, that's the copyright on the album was 1970.
Right. Yeah. Okay. And who came up with the title Cosmic Mind at Play? That's one of the songs, right?
Yes, that's one of my songs, Cosmic Mind at Play. That's sort of the way I, as I was having my mind expanded and pressured through the psychedelic 60s there. Why, yeah, my mind became cosmic, and I thought, how appropriate. And so then I would show my part of that song to Bill, and then, oh, yeah, well, here, let's add this part. And so then he would add a bridge to it, another part to it. So, yeah, that's how everything came together.
It seems to me that we decided to call it Cosmic Mind at Play as we were recording it.
Could have been.
Because, I remember when I got it, I remember thinking, good, they stayed with the name that we had picked out for the album. Because Cosmic Mind at Play was the lead-off tune.
Yes, that was song one, side one. Song two, side one, is a song called Now,
right,
written by Richard Tim and Bill Smith. Anything come to mind about Now?
Well, it was kind of what we were going through. And especially lyrically, the first part of the lyric, now as we awake to the superconscious state. This was a journey that individually was going on within at least myself, and what I could see was those around me. So we were on this, we were expanding to a cosmic sense of awareness, and little did I know that really we were just doing nothing but trying to listen to that inner spirit help direct us to a more higher state of living.
Anything about the song Smoky Windows ring a bell?
Yeah, Smoky Windows has a lot of things. I know Bob will be able to explain that.
Smoky Windows originally referred to a vehicle that you would be smoking pot in, and how the windows would get all fogged up, because that happened to Bill and I one time. And I believe Bill wrote that in Vancouver, but I'm not 100% sure, but I think he did. It was a fun, fun song to play.
Diana, his wife, had mentioned that, yeah, Smokey, that's what she would say. And she was the one that actually suggested
Smoky Windows.
The title. Well, why not call it Smoky Windows? There was a little play on some of the humor that us Paisleys would have, singing Oh Blah Dee Blah again, you know, kind of a little parody of the Beatles song. You know, they couldn't figure out how to do certain things. Oh Blah Dee Blah Da, right? So it's kind of a little take on that.
Okay, I skipped a song called Rockin', or is that part of Cosmic Mind at Play?
Yeah, that was the second part.
Second part of it, yeah.
Part of the Cosmic Mind at Play. That was Bill's interjection there.
Okay, and how about Diddley? What's that song about, written by Bill Smith?
Well, Diddley is based on the rhythm that Bo Diddley would have came out with, that one chord jam. And so that's where it started from. Bill said, well, he was just playing around with this Bo Diddley rhythm, and eventually that's kind of what it came out.
It went on from there, because I remember I didn't play the Bo Diddley drum beat to the song. I made up my own drumming to it.
Yeah. And well, that was always the mindset of the Paisleys, was always to learn from some fundamental source,
right.
And then we would do our own thing to it.
Right, expand from
so,
it.
Yep. So we weren't trying to really copy anybody. I don't think we ever consciously copied anybody. You know, a few hints at some humor.
Okay, then song six is Wind, also written by Bill Smith. Anything about that song you recall?
Well, I recall how that song developed. At the time, Brad was living at Bill's house upstairs. Bill was down in his basement working on this Beethoven piece, writing this thing, Wind, do-do-do, over and over and over. Upstairs, Brad is listening to it, and Brad has got his guitar on real small. So while Bill is writing this song down in his basement, Brad is upstairs on his guitar writing the lead guitar part. Later on, Bill comes up and says, "Hey, Brad, I wrote this new song. Come on down and listen to it." So Brad comes down, plugs in, and Bill says he starts playing this song, and suddenly Brad is playing this lead. And it was just magical. It just was. It fit together like a finger in a glove. And it went on and on and on, and it just threw this long progression. And it just kept escalating to the top. Unfortunately, the Beatles tried to do something very similar with the song She's So Heavy. And they get into this thing and they go over and over and they're going round and round and it resolves and resolves, but it never resolves totally. And even Brian Epstein said he didn't know, or not Brian Epstein, but
George Martin.
George Martin says he didn't know how to end it, so they just cut it. So the Beatles song abruptly ends, whereas Wind reaches that crescendo of release and then silently resolves back in. And one of Warren's genius ideas was to phase in this wind and phase it back out. And that was one of Warren's contributions.
A sound effect.
Yeah, a sound effect. Also on the song Now, there's this flrrr, now. And the way Warren got that effect was he would wrap a little piece of tape around the capstan of the tape recorder. And then as he played that, you'd get this little wobble in there. And that's how we did that. And then, of course, well, don't tell anybody. That's a trade secret, you know.
Now I understand, in addition to KQRS, you also got airplay on the University of Minnesota radio station, KUOM.
KUOM, yes. We had several friends over there. And at the time, there was, Bobby became a DJ over there. Then he got hit and had some brain damage. Bobby Golfus, well, who's another, he's from Robbinsdale, out there, high school rock and roll, you know, right? Rock and roll heaven there. Robbinsdale High School, there's more rock and rollers and bands out of Robbinsdale than any other high school that I know of.
Now, what do you recall about playing softball games with some of the band members from White Lightning and Gypsy?
Well, on occasion, you know, the West Bank, in between gigs, we would, you know, there was so much social interactions with the bands. It wasn't like we were so jealous of each other that we couldn't get along, or we couldn't sit down on a hill and get high together, or something. So I'm not even sure who organized the softball games, but we started holding these softball games, and anybody who wanted to come would come. And so we'd have, I remember guys like Zippy Kaplan and what was the bass player? Woody Woodrich was there. And we had all these rock and rollers just coming, not every gig, but the Paisleys, we both, Bill Smith and I, we played softball even before we became Paisleys. We were always on Crystal softball leagues or, you know, playing slow pitch softball. It was lots of fun. We always tried to challenge the Narcs. Oh, gosh, the Narcs would never play us, you know.
What about Prisoners?
Well, we did play. We went into Stillwater Prison. At that time, we were known as the West Bank Heads. So we had a lot of the folkies were joined us, you know, Ken Schaefer and Dean Carr. And, you know, a lot of West Bank hippies. And a lot of the band members from various bands. And we went out to, we got a gig at Stillwater Prison. And we went out there, and they had a ball field. And, of course, now, when I first met Bill Smith, I was in Red Wing training school. I used to steal cars when I was a young kid.
And hooligan.
Not a hooligan, but... You know, I just needed to get from point A to point B, and if I saw a car with keys, I'd jump in. Anyways, I was only 14, 15. So I'm in Red Wing, and I'm, at the time, working in the barber shop, and this other kid from Robbinsdale comes in, and his name is Bill Smith. And I guess he was in there for, I don't know, whatever. So that's where I cut Bill Smith's hair. I was his first barber, and I gave him a good haircut. So we go back way back to MSTS, we would call it, Minnesota State Training School. And that was kind of our survival training through there. So when we went to the prison, oh my goodness, both Bill and I, we knew several of the inmates there because we were in Red Wing with them. They never did get out of that prison mode, that mentality. And one of those kids, I remember his name is Mike Connors. He was even a tremendous athlete in Red Wing. He was just a natural. And so Mike Connors gets up to bat. And I'm saying to our left fielder, move back! Move back! This guy can hit! Ball is pitched to him, and bam! Mike Connors hits this ball, and it flies way over the left fielder's head, bounces off the back prison wall. Of course, he scores his home run. They killed us. Those prisoners, they just killed us. They were so good. It was lots of fun. But
okay. April 3rd, 1970, very historic day in Minnesota rock and roll history. The new depot opens, formerly the Greyhound bus station, in downtown Minneapolis, and Joe Cocker is in town on his Mad Dogs and Englishmen tour as the headliner for two nights in a row. What happens on the first night?
The first night, the opening act, as I remember it, was the Paisleys. So we opened the depot. The second band was the Flying Burrito Brothers.
I was gone.
And then was Joe Cocker. So, and Joe Cocker had, I think, 48 people on stage that night. They had the women, the kids, the groupies, the dogs were there. I think Leon Russell was on keyboards. And then their very last song, everybody from behind stage, they brought out these long boxes of roses. I don't know, there must have been a couple of dozen boxes of roses then that were opened on stage, and they threw the roses out into the audience. I haven't seen his movie Mad Dogs and Englishmen, but I understand there's a scene in there from that gig where that is shown in the movie, where they threw out all these roses.
Now, another date in history is May 9, 1970. There was a very large anti-war march that may have attracted over 40,000 people who walked along Summit Avenue and gathered at the state capitol in St. Paul. Ring a bell?
Absolutely. If I can't remember that one, I ain't going to remember anything. No, we were... The Paisleys were on the rotunda steps at the Capitol. We were setting up the equipment. We were we'd look inside the Capitol there, and all these guards inside there were chaining the doors with chains, and oh, you could tell they were just shitting in their pants, and they probably thought there was going to be a riot. Anyways, we're on the Capitol steps, and as I heard it, it was 100,000. Of course, maybe that, I don't know. Anyways, 100,000 people come marching arm in arm down Summit Avenue onto the Capitol grounds, up towards the Capitol, and it's the Paisleys that are playing. I always thought that as long as we were playing, it was going to be peaceful. We would play downtown Minneapolis in the midst of Nicollet Avenue with being surrounded by thousands and thousands and thousands of people protesting. Yeah. And it was the music that kept them from freaking out, as far as I'm concerned. And at the Capitol, we're standing next to guys like these AIM guys, the Native American Indian Movement, Clyde Belcourt, John Trudell, you know, Russell Means. I mean, and these guys are really angry. They got really legitimate reasons to protest. What's going on? As I mentioned earlier, it was a renaissance of activity in that time period. It just happened to be the war, the protesting of the war, that kind of coalesced everything. So now you got the Native Americans trying to gain more parity in this white culture. You got the Black Panthers. You got all these racial groups coming together, all under this same, hey, what about me? How about peace and love for me? How about us getting some of the benefits of this great culture that is promoted as being free for everybody? No, it's not free for everybody. There's a few people falling through the cracks. We got all kinds of people falling through the cracks. And that's what it was all about. I specifically remember those particular events. The guards inside chaining up the doors. Oh, they were just, they thought it was going to be another Bastille Banston, you know. It was fun.